We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey everyone, it's Lindsay Rhodes and I've got a new podcast, The NFL Roadshow. Fun and kind of nerdy conversation about the NFL every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I've got some amazing guests that are joining me. I'll be breaking the huddle with the top stories, previewing games. We'll get you set for the weekend fantasy with our Fantasy Friday episodes, and we'll answer some of your questions as well. So subscribe to the NFL Roadshow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Blue Wire.
What is up, Nets fans? Welcome to the Brooklyn Buzz. I'm Nick Fay. With me, as always, Jack Manuel. Jack, Nets lost tonight 116-111 in overtime to the Memphis Grizzlies. It was not a very good loss. How you feeling?
It was the most frustrated I've been since Caris LeVert sat on the bench in that OKC game, and this might be even higher frustration levels right now, Nick.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you guys know, Jack is usually super happy and cheery. I can see him on the video chat. He is not the happy Australian that I love. He is definitely disappointed right now. But as always, you can find the Brooklyn Buzz on all streaming platforms, including OTGBasketball.com, Blue Wire Pods, and NetsRepublic.com. But Jack, I guess let's start with overtime. We can dissect the game later, but overtime, obviously, it's a game of itself. The game's tied. You have a five-minute period to win. And I think to kick things off, the big surprise was Steve Nash elected to keep DeAndre Jordan in for overtime after having numerous mistakes down the stretch in the fourth quarter.
How does DeAndre Jordan get 30 minutes where he has two field goal attempts, nine boards, and is negative five in the game? Jared Allen's plus two, has 15 boards, has five offensive rebounds, 10 defensive rebounds, and is just better. He is a better basketballer. He played 8 minutes less. When the Brooklyn Nets were playing well, he was playing well. Jared Allen was out there. He was getting the boards. He was showing aggression. He was switching on to guys. Yet he elects to go from about like the 8 or 9 minute marker of the final quarter and all of OT apart from one possession to go with DeAndre Jordan, whose washed ass cost us the win in a lot of respects. I don't know, Nick. This is an elite level of stupidity from Steve Nash, a guy that we've given a lot of credit to, a lot of praise to, but he deserves all the criticism in the world right now. Unless Ime Udoka or Mike D'Antoni or Jacques Vaughn are like, nah, let's keep DJ out there. Them screens are looking good. He's looking good on that rebound and that putback dunk that was almost there. Absolute trash, Nick. Absolute goddamn trash.
And, like, there's so many different ways to break it down, too. Hey, I get DeAndre playing in the fourth quarter. You want to give Jared Allen a break. Bring him back in the three-minute mark. Let him play the final stretch of the game. Or whatever. You like the way that unit's playing. You want to let them finish the game. I get it. Whatever. I wouldn't have done that. But overtime. DeAndre Jordan cannot play 16 straight minutes of basketball or 14 minutes or whatever it is math-wise, 9 to 5, whatever, 14 minutes. So 14 minutes straight of basketball for DeAndre Jordan, who is past his prime. That alone doesn't make any sense. But let's go down the list of cons, Jack. So we had DeAndre Jordan. Now, the second pass wasn't great, but two passes hit his hands from Caris LeVert driving the lane, which probably could have either resulted in free throws, a layup attempt, or something. But instead, it resulted in a live ball turnover leading to Memphis Grizzly points. And then in the fourth quarter, I don't know if I've seen this from a veteran player ever in my entire life of watching basketball. His back was literally to the basketball. God. He did. He wasn't, and then they scored. He set a screen for the other team. Like, what are we doing here? That was just crazy. At that point, like, yo, you have to pull the player. I don't care if you're a veteran. I don't care if you're one of the best players in the league. Like, if you're doing something like that, that is just terrible stuff. And the hustle wasn't there. And not to mention, Memphis ran the same damn play. They ran a pick and roll with Tyus Jones and Jonas Valanciunas, and it resulted in a basket every single time or a shot that Memphis wanted. Not to mention, he was able to stop Valanciunas a few times in the post, but Valanciunas probably got the best of him tonight.
And he got him, you know, catching and jumping. But Nick, he had four blocks, though. He had four blocks, Nick.
All easy blocks. And all blocks, literally the type of blocks where they can get blocked into the play and, like, turn into something for the team. Sometimes he just smacks the ball. I mean, I get it. DeAndre has a role on this team, but this is not his role. There's no reason he should be playing more minutes than Jared Allen, especially in the way that we've seen Jared Allen play. I talked about it yesterday with Nolan Jensen on the Buzz recap. Jared Allen's been the third best net, and that was the case again tonight. I mean, you could argue he maybe was the most impactful guy. Yeah, he got beat in the post a couple times, but offensively, he provides that spark with his offensive rebounding and his quick rolls to the rim. And defensively, he can switch and he can make up so much space. And he also has the ability to show on some of those screens so Dylan Brooks doesn't get 100 free elbow jumpers.
You know what, Nick? Jared Allen deserves better than this. Honestly, he deserves better than this. He's taken middies now. You know, obviously we saw that in the Orlando bubble. We all were sort of reminiscing about it in a certain respect. He was just so much better, and it just makes no sense. It's like, if a dumb dude down in Australia with a dumb accent who doesn't know that much about basketball can figure it out, then a person who has 25 years experience playing basketball and coaching and whatever should be able to see that player is better than that player. Maybe I should swap those players and maybe the game will go better. But no, without Ja Morant as well, without Jaren Jackson, who didn't play at all, and thank God Ja Morant doesn't have a fracture, as we heard from Woj. I know that was a really scary injury, and anyone who's played basketball knows the pain that he's going through right now. So good to hear. Hopefully that recovery is swift and quick. But it was just idiocy, Nick. Absolute idiocy that we saw DeAndre Jordan play 30 minutes. DeAndre Jordan shouldn't play 30 minutes for the rest of the freaking season.
Yeah, unless it's a blowout in the first quarter and you're resting Jared Allen. Like, that's the only way. And I also wasn't a big fan of some of the rotation stuff we saw tonight, especially some of those lineups late. Like, I get playing Chris Gios and Caris LeVert at certain points. I think you should have mixed it up and kind of got LeVert out there with Joe Harris and Landry Shamet a little bit more, open up that spacing and allow, you know, Joe to get open, because they pretty much eliminated him from the game late in this game. I don't know if it was the Nets themselves not running enough actions, or maybe he was a little fatigued, or Memphis, you know, putting a little extra effort and making sure he didn't get the ball. But I mean, it was just tough to watch offensively down the stretch too, is because we just saw a lot of two passes and then shoot. You know what I mean? It was like a pick and roll with one player and then shoot, or whatever it might be. And like, as good as Caris LeVert is, that's probably not going to work. You need to get other guys to touch. And the same thing with Chris Gioza. For a guy that's like a pure point guard, I felt like there's a couple possessions I was just like, yo, your mid-range shot isn't that nice that you should only be passing the ball to yourself and taking it right there. So, I mean, I just thought there were so many issues from the entire team. I'm not sure anybody really played well tonight.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, TLC had an awesome first half. I thought he was sensational in that opening two periods. But are Chris Gios and Caris LeVert like Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving now? Do they just feel like they can ISO and create their own sort of offense and in an elite sort of, you know, manner? No, like, run some freaking sets. Like,
you think that is part of some of the talk we've heard from Steve Nash, where it's like, yeah, we haven't really spent much time on offense and we spent all this time on defense? Because like, we'd watch the game and there just wasn't any actions. And it's not like Kenny ran a ton of actions. It was kind of stuff implemented where the team would do it themselves, but we didn't see any of that.
No, we didn't. And we heard from Kyrie Irving in the earlier points of the season sort of saying that, you know, it's a lot of read and react sort of stuff, sort of just that sort of synergy. But when you don't have the IQ and execution of elite superstars out on the floor, you're relying on Caris LeVert, who is a third best player on most elite sort of teams, and Chris Gioza, who is like an eighth best player on any sort of, you know, ninth, tenth best player. He's only playing minutes because of the key injuries that are happening right now. I just thought that, look, I'm not going to say the word that I wrote down in my notes here in terms of the offense, but to put it in a more PG fashion, it was trash, Nick. Yeah. It was so goddamn just hard to watch, and it's just like, let's just try and move, have some player movement, have some ball movement. And it was just like static, 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 static.
We barely saw any possessions in that fourth quarter in overtime where all five guys touched the ball. You know what I mean? It was a lot of just two guys touching it, maybe three guys. It was just terrible. And like you said, TLC was great in the first half. Second half, he cooled off. And to be honest, his two live ball turnovers in overtime really killed the Nets because Memphis was not generating good offense, and giving them those two fast break opportunities probably was the difference in the overtime period.
It was. And there was obviously the Jeff Green box out that ended up in the foul call, and the Nets couldn't even get...
That call just drives me nuts, and I get it. It's a foul, but like, it's so ironic that Brandon Clark, the guy who committed probably five loose ball fouls in this game and didn't get called for one of them, gets essentially the most game-changing call when they just didn't call him for any of the same fouls, where there was plays where he clearly shoved Jared Allen in the chest.
It's, you know, and I think as well, I was more frustrated at the fact that the Nets couldn't even get the defensive board because they would have had a shot to tie the game and take it to double OT. It's just like the basic things, or the basic fundamentals of quality NBA basketball just went out the window in the final 15 minutes of the game. Yeah. It was just hard to watch. And I mean, there were moments throughout the first sort of two and a half, three quarters where it's like, oh, here we go. There's a bit of energy here. There's the bubble net. You know, everyone's contributing. There's some hustle plays. There's some steals. There's guys jumping in the lane, fast break sort of shots. And I'm just like, all right, there's something here. But then it was just like, oh my God. My levels of frustration couldn't. And I mean, some of it is on coaching, and we've probably alluded to that a little bit, but a lot of it is on the guys to be able to, all right, you guys are smart enough and have played enough basketball here to be able to, you know, DeAndre, maybe don't hang out in the dunker spot for like 18 seconds. I literally saw, and I'm not sure if you did as well, Nick, and I didn't want to tweet it out because it's an irrelevant sort of a take, but KD was like, go screen. Like, he yelled out to him because the clock was just running down. It's just like, it's just so easy to defend, and the Memphis Grizzlies aren't the Milwaukee Bucks or the Boston Celtics in that respect. You are making it easier to defend. Kevin Durant, ISO possession. Kyrie Irving, ISO possession. That's hard to defend. A Chris Chios and Caris LeVert, ISO possession. I'd take that as a win if you're Taylor Jenkins and the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yeah, 100%, especially when a lot of the other guys on the floor aren't hitting their shots and making them pay. You know what I mean? When they do. So it's just like they're collapsing the paint. These guys are getting there, having to settle for mid-range shots. It was tough to watch, like you said. And I mean, not to like keep piling on Steve Nash, but I just felt like it was weird that we didn't see Tyler Johnson or Bruce Brown. Like, no. The offense is stagnant, and these are two players that can create for themselves and create for others. You know, Tyler Johnson doesn't do an extremely high level, and Bruce Brown probably doesn't either, but when you don't have much of that from anybody but Caris LeVert and Chris Chioza, you need to incorporate those guys. Like, there's just way too many sets where it's one player dependent, and like, you're depending on so much off-ball action that you don't even have designed. Like, how do you expect to win?
Do you really like it? No player at this point in the season should be playing 40 minutes plus. Joe Harris, 42. Caris LeVert, 38. TLC, 40. Go a little bit deep into the rotation. You said, like, in the first game of the season, we want to go 10 deep. You went 9 tonight. Throw another ball handler out there. We lost Spencer Dinwiddie. We lost Kyrie Irving. Those are two of the better ball handlers, if not the best ball handlers on this team. You know, you can make an argument for Caris LeVert, but, you know, Tyler Johnson showed plenty in the Orlando bubble. Bruce Brown, I don't know what he's done. Now, we've sort of said that, you know, alluded to maybe like preseason struggles or issues sort of there. And look, he's shown great energy and been a great teammate on the bench. But I have no idea why these two capable NBA players, capable starters, are getting relegated, and 27 minutes for Chris Chioza is far too much for my liking as well. You know, I'm cool with 18 to 25 as a max, but, you know, him sort of ISOing and taking these possessions, I'm like, this is just a miss. Like, he's better when he's passing. He's better when he's looking for others. His best skill is his facilitation, and it was nice to see him hit those three threes, and I thought that he looked quite fluid there, but a lot of those weren't, you know, pull-up threes that you would see from the likes of Kyrie Irving or whatever. I just thought there were
like patient threes where, like, the defense just literally didn't come out, and he's like, hey, I'm going to shoot the three. And to be honest, I don't even give a shit if he takes step-back threes. Like, taking step-back mid-range jump shots contested over a bigger defender, like, it makes absolutely no sense. It's just bad basketball. Like, Kyle Anderson was on him, who has, what, a foot almost on him? Like, literally, and he's trying to shoot a contested fadeaway mid-ranger on him. Like, come on, man. Like, what are we doing here?
we sort of alluded to that we expected Steve Nash to show some experimentation, a bit of openness, a bit of malleability. You know, we didn't expect Kenny Atkinson 2.0 in a lot of sort of respect, and we got that. You know, these are the level of frustrations when it comes to rotations, giving DeAndre Jordan too many minutes, and it's just like, am I living in a twilight zone? I'm like experiencing way too much deja vu right now. I just thought that there was, it was ours for the taking, Nick. You know, that everything was there. You know, Ja Morant unfortunately got injured. You know, Caris LeVert was starting to heat up a little bit. You know, TLC was looking good. But then the trajectory of the game completely flipped when DeAndre Jordan was reinserted. Jared Allen's intangible energy, let alone his on-court efficiency and production on both ends of the floor, was why we lost the game. Obviously, there are a multitude of factors that we have discussed, but for me, that is the number one thing because, like you mentioned, Jared Allen was our best player out there, yet he played the least amount of minutes other than Torian Prince.
Yeah, I don't understand. And, like, maybe Steve Nash is thinking Jonas Valanciunas would get the best of him, but, like, they did a nice job of throwing some double teams at him when Jared Allen was out there. And it's not like Memphis is filled up with, like, elite three-point shooting. Like, it was just – it was a bad game on so many different levels, from coaching to playing to effort at times. And I felt like Memphis got every loose ball in the overtime. Like, there was a couple balls, or even in the end of the fourth quarter.
That doesn't happen if Jared Allen's out there, Nick. That's what he was doing when he was out there in the third.
He was
fighting like eight other. He had like four Memphis Grizzlies on him, and he still got the offensive board.
Yeah, and he was ready to punch a couple of them in the face. I mean, he was an angry Jared Allen tonight again, and I love to see it. He's becoming a really, really good player, and it sucks that he wasn't given the opportunity to get us the win, which he deserved to do because of the way he played tonight and how he played in the previous three games.
I still, like, looking at the box score, and we've got the stats up right now as we sort of, you know, go through this. He played 22 minutes. Torian Prince played 19. Jeff Green played 24. Landry Shamet played 24. Chris Scherzer played 27. DeAndre Jordan played 30. All of these players played more than our best player tonight. And yet Caris LeVert obviously is the fulcrum, and we needed him out there, and he needs to have 35-plus minutes in a game like today. But even then, Jared Allen and Caris LeVert have such awesome chemistry.
That's what I was going to say too, Jack. It's like, the offense sucks. Okay, let's go to one of our best pick-and-roll combos, the one that has maybe the longest chemistry to anybody else on the team. It literally does, and we didn't go to that very much at all, and it's just like, it was frustrating.
2020 has reshaped how we work, and it's almost over. Businesses across the globe are challenged to be more efficient, which means every hire is critical. Indeed is here to help. Indeed is the number one job site in the world with more total visits than any other job site, according to ComScore. Indeed helps you find quality candidates quickly, so you can focus on hiring the person you need to keep your business going. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need, you can pause your account at any time, and there's no long-term contracts. And now, Indeed's new way of matching with candidate instantly delivers a short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job criteria that you can contact the moment you sponsor a job, making Indeed the only site that moves as fast as you do. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. This is their best offer anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/BlueWire. Offer valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply. The wait is finally over. Football is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get on every possible chance to win the season, from game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props. BetOnline gives you more options to wager than anywhere else. You can get in on their season opening bonuses today and start off wagering on wins, divisions, and championship futures all day, every day. Head to BetOnline today. Take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Don't forget to use promo code BLUEWIRE at BetOnline.ag. That's BLUEWIRE, all one word, BetOnline, your online sportsbooks experts.
And at no point did I feel like we had the best five nets out there from tonight. Like, I didn't feel like at any point where Steve Nash was like, wow, this is a really good lineup. Like, I would have probably closed with Jared Allen, Jeff Green, Caris LeVert, Joe Harris.
TLC?
I think TLC. Maybe Landry Shamet, but probably TLC.
Yeah, I would probably.
I thought Jeff Green was pretty solid too, and I thought he was a nice matchup for Brandon Clarke, even though obviously that foul call at the end, but he was the only one that has the physicality and the athleticism to match a guy like that.
Four of those five guys you mentioned, Nick, were plus in the plus minus. So, I mean, we look at the plus minus probably a little bit more than a lot of other podcasts because we do one game sample size podcast. So we go, and does that reflect what we sort of see? Well, yeah, it does. Caris LeVert, plus seven, you know, the best player, the most important player out there on the floor, even though some of his shot selection was certainly iffy, he's still the best player out there, and you need to be playing your best player the most amount of minutes. TLC, plus three. Yeah, he was electric in that first half, giving us so much energy, and obviously did taper off in that second sort of half. Jeff Green, plus seven on the night, just did a lot of good things. You know, just was a solid serviceable wing, much more than Torian Prince taking eight shots in, what, two fucking possessions? I don't know. Sorry, pardon my language. And then Jared Allen, obviously, plus two. And we've made many gripes about the lack of Jared Allen in the closing portions of the game, Nick. But I don't know. I'm befuddled in a lot of ways. And it's just weird because we expect more. And we just get the same thing again. And I get that we get probably more rash and more over hyperbolic in the moment because we do game by game sample size. Like, you and Nolan probably were a bit frustrated, but like me, it was just like, you know what, you take that. You know, there was just a lack of energy, and you know, the Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Knicks that night as well, but there were so little excuses to not win this game. This could come back to haunt the Nets if it means, like, you know, a home court advantage. This is a win that you needed to bank, especially after, you know, Ja Morant went down, because, you know, what is the offensive talent on the Memphis Grizzlies? You know, Jonas Valanciunas.
Got murdered by freaking Tyus Jones and freaking Dylan Brooks.
Kyle Anderson in that first half, yeah. Slow-mo, a dude that moves faster than maybe a snail, I don't know. But in saying that, that's full credit to the Memphis Grizzlies for taking the most of and executing much better and pouncing on Brooklyn Nets' mistakes. And yeah, and a lot of that was Steve Nash, and a lot of that was on the players too.
Yeah, and even going to the final possession of regulation where Karras took a step back three after he missed one a couple of possessions prior, it's like I felt like he was too concerned with using the clock instead of trying to get a shot that he wanted. And obviously it's a tough balance because you want to make sure you don't give the other team a possession, but I just felt like that wasn't a shot. I felt I would have been happier with I would have been happy with him taking a mid-range shot there because I think he's a little bit more comfortable with a step-back mid-ranger or one of those weird type of floaters that we'd see. And then you have a chance to get the foul call, like going at the player, especially Kyle Anderson, who had a couple, honestly, just dumb fouls tonight. He had four fouls on the night, and they weren't good ones.
Yeah, it felt like there was an inconsistency in their mentality. You know, yeah, they were wanting to drive sometimes, and they were just wanting to avoid contact and wanting to get contact, and they weren't getting calls, and they were sometimes getting calls, and then Memphis was getting calls. We always gripe about, you know, the officiating in certain respects and the fact that there was the missed goaltend. But, you know, Caris LeVert also traveled to end the first half. That was a travel, like, and watching that. And so it sort of evens itself out in a lot of respects. And it wasn't the officiating that cost us tonight. It was a lack of execution and poor coaching.
Yeah, and I don't think the officiating was good, but like you said, there still was an opportunity to win the game, and I felt like at times the players allowed bad officiating to influence their effort a little bit too much, which is frustrating. It's hard to do, but you are a professional, and you just got to keep driving, even if they're not going to call the calls. And I mean, when Joe Harris and Caris LeVert both get texts, usually something's a little bad because they're two guys that don't necessarily yell too much at the refs, especially Joe Harris. That was, I think, his first tech of his career.
It was. And, you know, when Joe Harris is angry, normally it's a nice thing for me because, you know, it makes me feel a bit more pleasant. And, you know, I like a bit of aggression in the people in my life. But also,
what'd you think about his final shot?
It wasn't his best.
Step in for the mid-ranger, or you thought the three was the best bet?
His midi wasn't on tonight. Yeah, yeah. I think his mid-range shot wasn't on tonight. So I think that he looked more comfortable with the three. I don't think it was the best shot in the world, but it was a decent enough shot that, you know, he could hit maybe six times out of 10, five times out of 10. You know,
he didn't look comfortable.
No, I don't think that. I think, you know, uncomfortable is probably a great way to describe a lot of this game. There was just so many.
For the fans and the players.
Yeah, there was just so many inconsistencies. If we're talking about, like, it's like a roller coaster, I think, that this sort of game. There was the peaks and valleys of, you know, TLC, and then there was the lows of DeAndre Jordan and, you know, screening for the opposition. I no. There was just a lot of, and look, if we go back to the first half, Nick, Why is Torian Prince ISOing and taking seven shots to start off the game?
5 seconds into the possession, too. It wasn't even like we're talking about, like, hey, whatever. If Torian Prince has to take the last shot 5 times in a row and that's just how it goes, whatever. But, like, he literally came down the court and he was like, yo, I'm Kevin Durant. Like, that's what he tried to do. That's what he was, like, trying to fill in for. It's like, no, that's not your game, you know? I mean, I was happy to see him finally hit a three, I think. Was that the first time he hit one this season?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was, I think, you know, over 11 with the Landry Shaman. And I don't know. I think, you know, you and Nolan sort of, you know, chatted about it on the last buzz. But, you know, I have a bit of faith in Landry Shaman much more than Torian Prince. This feels like, you know, Alan Crabb 2.0, one of the few blemishes on Sean Marks's resume. But, man, I just thought he was goddamn awful. And, you know, sometimes you shoot to get into rhythm, but you need to have a level of IQ. And Torian Prince is showing that he's just like, you know, what are you doing? Your decision making on the offensive end of defense.
He's like the Nets Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah, yeah, or Kelly Oubre or whoever, whatever athlete who can't shoot the ball and doesn't have, you know, great execution. You know, insert Torian Prince there. So, I mean, I was a bit harsh calling him the worst player in the NBA earlier in the night, but he's playing like it right now. And look, it's great. You know, got to the line 4 times and had a couple of rebounds there, but he's just not adding anything to this team right now. And you know, Jeff Green, obviously, you know, getting more minutes. There was at least one good thing that Steve Nash did, giving him the large majority of the minutes at the small forward / power forward position. But, man, it was rough time. It's rough for Torian Prince right now because my Kool-Aid is getting dry right now.
I think it got moldy.
Yeah, I don't know what Kool-Aid does. I don't think I've ever actually had it before. But in saying that, he's not playing well, and he doesn't deserve to be getting rotation minutes. And saying that, you know, just give minutes all those minutes to TLC in the next game against Atlanta.
Yeah, honestly, I thought this to myself. I would have rather seen Rodion tonight.
Yeah, look, there's a fair argument that can be made for it. I wanted to see Bruce Brown. You know, I put it out there on Twitter. I'm like, where's Bruce? Why aren't we seeing him play this man? I don't know what he's done to go from being, you know, a Nets killer in seasons past to being so deep out of the rotation that Chris Scioscia is getting 27 minutes and Torian Prince is getting 19 minutes over him.
I just thought, like, I said this before and I tweeted this out, I just felt like it was a great opportunity to play Bruce Brown and Tyler Johnson, not only for the other aspects of their game, but they're both physical players that play with high energy, and this Memphis team is super chippy, and they're mad annoying. Like, that's just how they play. They have guys like Dylan Brooks. They have guys like Jonas Valanciunas. Like, they just kind of get under your skin a little bit, and the Nets needed to respond to that with some of the guys of their own. A Tyler Johnson, a Bruce Brown, pick them up full court. Like, you said it, Jack. John Morant and Jaren Jackson were out of this game. You play freaking Bruce Brown, he's locking up whoever's playing lead ball handler for the Memphis Grizzlies. Like, he's that good, and they're that bad. Like, they're not a great team. And I thought just that type of energy and those type of defensive stops would have been perfect in a game like this, because the Nets offense wasn't cooking, so they needed to win another way, and they just didn't do it.
Yeah, big time. Look, heck, Reggie Perry would have been better than DeAndre Jordan tonight. Like, I might be going a bit over the top here, but Reggie Perry at least gives you energy and engagement. And I just thought that, you know, it was just so damn frustrating. And the good thing about basketball is that you get another opportunity to sort of, you know, put the blemishes behind you. But, man, they need to execute. And, you know, we can't be relying on the likes of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving for this 72-game season. We need to get the habits right at this early sort of point in time. And, you know, a lot of the positives that we took away from game 1 and 2 are starting to be overshadowed by the blemishes of tonight's performances and a little bit in Charlotte as well.
Yeah, and our guy Matt Brooks, who was at the Steve Nash press conference, Zoom conference, whatever the hell we call it these days, Steve Nash says he went with DeAndre Jordan down the stretch to counter Jonas Valanciunas.
Oh, my God! Sorry, everyone who's listening right now. Counter Jonas Valanciunas. He's not Nikola Jokic or Jerome Beadle or Anthony Davis. He's Jonas Valanciunas.
Yeah.
Ah, Nick.
And it's not even like Memphis has the type of spacing that prevents you from ever sending help towards him. You know what I mean? Like, they're playing mediocre three-point shooters. Yes, some of them hit shots tonight, but they're just not that level of player. And, man, it's tough. And, like, I just don't know.
I don't know either. He had, look, for the record, Jonas Valanciunas had 14 points and 14 boards on 6 of 11 from the field. Good. Didn't have any offensive boards, though. You know, Jared Allen was the one fighting there and fighting over him. again, I think that it isn't. And whoever asked that question, thank you. You know, whether it was Matt or someone else in the Nets media, you know, I was clamoring for that question. I think everyone on Nets Twitter and any fan who watched this game was probably wondering, oh, why is DeAndre Jordan in his washed-ass Timberlands playing out there over a guy who has a level of spryness and athleticism that impacts winning basketball on ways more than both ends? You know, he fights for boards. He switches out onto guards and wings. He did it like three or four times tonight, you know, and I was just like, Jared's going to be fine here. He's going to be fine. And he was. I said it earlier, and I'd say it again. Jared Allen deserves better. You know, whether Steve Nash trades him for whoever else in the NBA, Jared Allen deserves to be starting because he is much better, and he's a starting caliber player, and he's only going to get better. DeAndre Jordan is getting worse. The trajectories of their career, for those playing along at home, I'm moving my arms just in the opposite ways.
It's like the emojis, the one that's going up and the one that's going down.
Basically, it is infallible and inscrutable. I don't know if I'm actually saying words that are actually in the dictionary right now, Nick, but it begs belief. I don't know why DeAndre Jordan plays over a above average, really good basketballer at the same position who does the same things but better and also other things better. It just seems so simple.
Yeah, I mean, it really does, Jack, and it's frustrating. Hopefully this is a learning moment for Steve Nash that he can kind of look back throughout the season and realize, like, hey, we should never play DeAndre Jordan in overtime or down the stretch. It just isn't working. Sadly, Jack, we haven't even talked about the worst Nets news of the day. And one of our favorite Nets players, Spencer Dinwiddie, suffered an injury yesterday. It turned out it was a partially torn ACL, which is positive and negative at the same time. It sucks he has a partially torn ACL, but it's good that it was in a complete tear and there wasn't a ton of other damage to his knee. So it's very likely he should be able to make a full recovery. Who knows if that'll be with the Nets, but we wish Spencer the best and hope that, you know, we can see the best version of him next season.
He deserves to get paid wherever he is, whether it's in Brooklyn, whether it's on an opposing team. There is not a better dude in the NBA than Spencer Dinwiddie in what he has shown and what he has turned himself into, to being a castaway in Chicago, a castaway in Detroit, to being a guy that deserves to be paid, you know, the likes of Fred VanVleet and Malcolm Brogdon money. Give him $15, $20 million because this man deserves it. He took unders for the Brooklyn Nets in the first place because he wanted to be here. And and obviously we were like, oh, is he going to adjust? Is he going to be able? And I was just like, you know what? He's going to be able to do this. He's going to be playing a crucial role for the Brooklyn Nets come the playoffs. And look, it's partially torn, as you mentioned, Nick, and you know, he posted to his Instagram and that he's motivated, and you know, he's torn it before, you know, in January 12, 2014, in a college game against UW. You know, it was a really lengthy Instagram post, and I highly recommend everyone checking it out. Karis Avert, obviously being the dude that he is, opened up his presser, you know, sending prayers and thoughts out to Spencer Dinwiddie, as we all have. You know, I think if you want to read it, go read it. But for me, I want to read the last paragraph, Nick, the last paragraph in a bit, because it just alludes to me to the character and just awesomeness of just Spencer Dinwiddie as a human being. He said, so now we're here, a contract-based partial ACL tear. No other structural damage, minimal swelling, and cartilage intact, proving the years of work did their job and protected me. Pre-op prognosis, this surgery should be very simple and straightforward. Virtually no non-weight bearing period post-op either. Honestly, Spence, your knee looks a lot younger than most 27-year-olds. Awesome to hear. And also he said this. So in summary, if anything, I'm excited because I've made a living off beating the odds. And these odds say at worst, I'll be more than 100% by next season. Next question. Will I miss the road to a Brooklyn Nets 2021 championship? My response, as we've seen before, crazy things have happened. I goddamn hope that if anyone is going to recover before, you know, the Brooklyn Nets are in the playoffs or in the finals, it's Spencer goddamn Dinwiddie, because this man is a goddamn marvel. He's a superhero. He's Iron Man. And I can't wait to see him back playing basketball, because he's going to be lighting it up. He's going to be driving on fools. He's going to be taping step back threes, sidestep threes on him. He's going to be playing some really good defense as well. Can't wait to see him back, and thoughts and prayers up to him. And, you know, he's going to be fine. Like you said, his knees are going to be great and he's going to come back better than ever.
Yeah, the fact that there's a period where there's essentially no period where he can't put weight on the knee is very positive, because it allows him to get the rehab extremely fast. And ACL injuries have come a long way. I mean, recovering in 6 months would be an extreme. I wouldn't completely rule it out. I think the fact that the Nets are ultra conservative, they probably wouldn't play him out there, but I think Spencer should still set that goal if that's what he wants to do. You know what I mean? And the positive news, too, was I believe he tore his left ACL in college. Yeah. This is his right one. So, obviously, knee structure, it should be fine. So, you know, obviously, we wish Spencer the best. And I will say this, and I don't really want to dive into the contract stuff because I always feel like that's kind of rude because this is a guy's life. But I will say there's probably there is a slim chance that he could opt in next year.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a piece, I'm not sure if you saw it, Nick, via Hoops Hype, and they were sort of asking different conference executives around the league, and you know, they were kind of split on whether he wanted to opt into that $12 million or whether he, you know, could. He'd be one of the better free agents on the market yep. right now with, you know, the likes of Paul George and Rudy Gobert, you know, deciding to re-up with their respective teams. I think that what is interesting is I just, whatever happens to him, Spencer Dinwiddie's going to be fine. You know,
And also, I'll say this sucks too, is because Spencer was the complete opposite of an asshole this season. He literally bought into his role in a contract year, played in this like little glue guy role where he knew his stats wouldn't look nice. He would impact winning, but it wouldn't necessarily earn him this biggest possible contract. And he didn't complain one single time. And he had to do some tough stuff out there, bang around with a lot of guys, being slightly undersized against some of the forwards they would match him up with. And he did a really good job this season. And it sucks too, is because like, I know a lot of people were like, oh, Spencer Dinwiddie, I don't know how he fits in the starting lineup. But it felt like at some point it was going to click because he's a guy that we've seen adjust in the past, and it just takes some time for him. And then as soon as he gets full cylinder, it would have probably unlocked something different for the Nets.
Yeah, big time. I can't wait for him to come back. You know, he's always going to have a soft spot in our hearts at the Brooklyn Buzz and for Brooklyn Nets fans in general. He's endeared himself in a way that few can. And you know, one of the really great stories of just, you know, similar to Joe Harris, you know, these sort of guys that are just sort of like, you know what, I'm going to find a diamond in the rough here. And Spencer Dinwiddie has, you know, elevated himself to being a quality NBA player, fringe all-star. And I'm pretty confident he's going to get back to there. And I'm hoping it's on the Brooklyn Nets, but if it's not, then, you know, full faith and full power to him to get back to producing at a really high level. But Nick, did you want to discuss any of the sort of things like the disabled player exception and the ramifications around James Harden that Zach Lowe discussed, or did you want to leave those to the side?
Yeah, we could discuss them. I mean, the Nets could apply for the disabled player exception. What is it, like $5.7
million? $5.7 million, yep. And Bobby Marks said that the DPE would see the Nets tax bill go from 58.7 to 82.7. But it actually wouldn't because the tax is based off a percentage of revenue. So, you know, it's going to be like 40.
He has no idea, yeah.
Yeah, there's literally no idea at this sort of point in time. So, look, there are some guys that are certainly out there that the Nets could sort of target. And this is via Russell and Fro on Twitter. And he sort of put out some different names. Garrett Temple, Nicola Melli, Kent Bazemore, MKG, James Ennis, Bismack Biyombo, Wayne Ellington, Brad Wanamaker, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Michael Beasley, Damari Carroll, Wilson Chandler, Kyle Korver, Alonzo Trier, and Trevion Graham. Not world beaters in any sort of respect of the word, but we need a rotation player, Nick. And
Jack, say the first three for me again.
We got Garrett Temple, Nicola Melli, and Kent Bazemore.
Yeah, Garrett Temple.
Yeah, let's get
back. I think that makes the most sense. I don't know. Chicago's look really, really bad. So maybe they might be willing to do anything. If you could send them maybe even like Rodions or something for them, or I don't know what it might be, but something to consider. Obviously, we've been hoping Trevor Ariza would be bought out at some point. That'd be another guy. The interesting thing that we could put
George
the Nets.
Hill.
Yeah, George Hill for in a possible trade. I think the interesting thing for the Nets would be if they apply for this disabled player exception and then they still have their mini mid-level exception. I don't know the cap ramifications on this, so I could be completely wrong. So double-check me if you want. But then they'd have two non-minimum deals they could offer to buyout candidates, which would be substantially more than any other team would have.
And the Nets still have, you know, future first rounders in their current first rounder for the upcoming draft in 2021. For the likes of, you know, the Clippers and the Lakers and these sort of teams can't necessarily offer other teams. You know, we saw Marcus Morris go to the Los Angeles Clippers and make, you know, maybe not the biggest impact, but he was certainly, you know, a key part of their rotation towards their success or lack thereof. So then the Brooklyn Nets are in somewhat of a prime position to add some level. Look, George Hill is probably the top of my list, Nick. And, you know, we know how OKC love those first rounders. Give him TP, give him a first rounder, and, you know, let's be done with the TP experience and get a guy who I think would be, you know, probably start for the Brooklyn Nets in George Hill. You know, I'm all in on the George Hill experience, and he just knows how to play effective basketball, an awesome shooter, really, really great shooter, and I think would be a good leader as well, a good defender. You know, it makes so much sense. You know, that or Trevor Ariza or both, if I'm greedy, to be honest, as well.
Yeah, I would like George Hill. I might not even start him. I think he'd almost be a perfect second unit player to have with Caris LeVert, because he's not necessarily your true point guard. He's more of that secondary ball handler, almost a 3-and-D point guard. That's why he fits so nice in Milwaukee. So that'd be a great thing. I mean, if we're talking about issues the Nets are having, I think also, you know, what we discussed all offseason and the problem that we said this team would have is that lack of wing forward defender. And I think they're lacking the elite athlete. You know what I mean? Like the other big athlete to throw against guys like Miles Bridges, PJ Washington, Brandon Clark, just some of those guys. And I don't think you want KD to bang with those guys every single night of the season. So I think that's still going to be something Sean Marks revisits. You know what I mean? Like it's even almost still more important than even adding another guard, because I think there's guards in house that could step up and be better if Steve Nash gives them the opportunity.
Yeah, look. Aaron Gordon is the name that obviously does spring to mind, and if the name that sprung to mind for the past.
That's like, I just kind of set you up for that, just the way like Caris LeVert threw that no-look pass to Joe Harris.
Only good moment from tonight, Nick. It was so damn pretty. My body flooded. It was so damn gorgeous. It was, you know, a mini bright spot in an otherwise pretty lackluster night from the Brooklyn Nets. Nick, because there's just a lot of sort of Nets stuff, you know, bumbling around right now, I wanted to ask a little bit about the James Harden stuff. We heard Zach Lowe go on the Low Post today, and when he was talking about the ramifications of the Brooklyn Nets training for James Harden with Spencer Dinwiddie's injury, he said this: Spencer Dinwiddie's health did not make or break the Nets' ability to get James Harden. It's unclear to me, frankly, if those teams have had anything resembling a conversation about James Harden. Let's make that clear. I don't sense that there's been hardly any traction there at all. And maybe the way the Nets have started had them thinking, why are we messing with this? The key to Brooklyn potentially training for Harden has believed to be centered more on their ability to put a young star from another team in a three-team package. Do you agree, Nick, or do you actually think that the Spencer Dinwiddie would have been part of some level of package and maybe you have to replace it with, like, you know, a more unprotected first rounder if James Harden is still on the cards? Because, man, he looked pretty good. As fat as he is and as chunky as he is and as much of a dickhead he is off the court, and I said that on JBT, he's still an elite basketballer.
Yeah, I don't think Spencer was always a big piece of the trade. I think there was options on the table where he wasn't maybe even included, because I heard that rumble around from some of the NBA media. I'm not sure exactly who it was, but it also was the fact that Spencer was on an expiring contract, and that didn't necessarily provide a ton of value for Houston. So I'm not surprised. But where it does hurt Brooklyn is the fact is Spencer could have been used in that three-team trade or four-team trade going somewhere else, helping them either acquire another asset or being part of the package that, quote-unquote, gets Houston that young player they want.
Yeah, we'll wait and see how it pans out. We chat enough about James Harden, and you know, we don't have to necessarily revisit that. But a final thing I wanted to get to, Nick, and you might have some other sort of ideas about when you wanted to touch on, but Malika Andrews put out a pretty interesting stat surrounding the Nets with and without Durant and Irving on the floor. KD and Kyrie have played 95 minutes together this season. The Nets have outscored their opponents by 64 points in that span. I know Zach Lowe also said that the starting unit is like plus 30 in net rating. You know, it's gargantuan. They've been awesome. The Nets have played 49 minutes without either player on the court and were outscored by 18 points. Do you think that Steve Nash needs to start staggering these dudes?
Yeah, I always thought that should have been the case. I think we actually discussed maybe this in the rotation talk we did preview-wise. Like, I knew that KD and Kyrie wanted to play a lot of their minutes together, but I don't think we've seen like KD and Kyrie on the floor by themselves for like longer than a minute stretch, if that. You know what I mean? Like, it always makes sense to stagger. And now with Spencer being out, it's a higher priority. Like, I think ideally what you want to have as the Nets, you want to have two of your three best players in the court at all times. So you want to have a combination of either Caris LeVert and Kyrie Irving, Caris LeVert and Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. You know what I mean? Something along those lines, because it's just so hard to put that pressure on one person. I mean, obviously, if it's Kevin Durant or Kyrie Irving, they can do it for stretches too. But I think it's tough to ask Caris LeVert to do that for stretches in this game if he doesn't have any other type of like ball handlers out there.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have and obviously losing Spencer Dinwiddie as well. I think that Steve Nash is going to actually have to show some coaching chops now,
yep,
and not just be the cool dude on TikTok. And I've given him a little bit
fired. Woo!
I've given him a lot of shit tonight, but you know, that's what happens when you get emotional, Nick. You get a bit too rash and a bit over the top. But I think that it makes the most sense. You know, it seems to me that it's almost like an old school OKC way of thinking, where it's just like, you know, Russ and KD would always play together, and then they get subbed off by Scott Brooks, and obviously, you know, Kuznetsov's out James Harden to some sort of extent. So maybe there's some sort of similarity that he's sort of taking from there. But, you know, I think that he's going to have to experiment and not show rigidity. That, and I love using that word, because, you know, this is not the season to go and stick to your guns and stick to your laurels, because especially if it's not working, because Katie and Kyrie are awesome and they feed off each other. They have great synergy. But you know what? Sub out Kyrie a little bit earlier, bring in Karis and have Karis and KD cook a little bit, or have Karis and Kyrie cook a little bit. They've always, you know, we've seen the sample size in the past that they've been good when they're on the floor together. And unless you wanted to add something else, Nick, we do have confirmation about what you alluded to earlier about that OT possession.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything else. I just think Nash needs to get more creative with his rotation. This isn't soccer. This isn't hockey. You don't have set stuff where you sub those guys in. You have to change. There's feel of the game. There's matchups. And I obviously know that you don't want to completely change your game plan for every team you play, but you do have to match up sometimes when you're at a disadvantage. And I just think that's something we haven't necessarily seen from Steve Nash yet. And to be honest, like, a lot of the stuff in the wins was just the players being so good. Like, and them just playing at such a high level against Boston, Golden State. And they didn't play that way against Charlotte, and obviously didn't play that way tonight. But there's still areas where they could have put themselves in better positions so things were easier and they didn't have to be these elite, amazing players and shoot 45% from three.
Yeah, as coaches, your job is to give your players the tools and systems to be able to succeed at a high level and execute at a high level. And there are some parameters in this point of the season that we're quite high on. You know, when KD and Kyrie are there, you know, the synergy and on offense is certainly a bit better. Obviously, their just greatness and gargantuan talents certainly override that. But also the defense looks pretty good because KD is showing something and he's jumping at shots. I don't want him necessarily jumping at, but it's a good sign that he has that confidence to go up and try and block PJ Washington and Terry Rozier, even if he does get put on the poster. But what I was alluding to, Nick, is this is via Alex Schiffer off The Athletic. On the OT possession, Joe Harris said the play was drawn up to ISO Karis on the block. Harris was used as the emergency option. So you're a smart man, Nick.
Oh, well, I mean, it was pretty, like, I mean, it was kind of almost obvious. And I'm just like, TLC, why are you not making that pass? I don't know if the angle was too hard or he wasn't. And, like, I'll be honest, if you're not confident to make a tough pass as an inbounder, you shouldn't be inbounding. You know what I mean? Yep. I also kind of thought it was weird to have, I think it was TLC, right? Inbounding? Yeah, it was TLC inbounding. You think it would be someone who's a good passer. Like, I'm not trying to throw shade at TLC, but I can't remember in my head ever seeing him throw like an elite level pass.
One quote as well from Alex Schiffer here. Steve Nash said the team was tired on the second end of a back-to-back, was trying to get the ball in Karras' hand in that late OT possession. If they're tired, why are you playing nine guys? And why are you playing them 40 minutes plus? Why aren't you doing what Nick and I alluded to? And yeah, we're going to be podcast coaches here in that sort of respect. But you've got the depth of talent to be able to alleviate those concerns and alleviate those the tiredness and the lack of execution on both ends. Stop here. Call a timeout. Insert it, dude. Try and just get wacky with it. It's like he was afraid to be wrong in front of KD and Kyrie that were sitting on there. So it's like, you know what? I better play DJ a few more minutes because or Spencer or Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant are going to get angry at me because I'm not playing their best friend. You know,
even think it's the case anymore. Like,
I don't think it is either.
After the game, maybe with Kyrie, I'm not sure, but with Kevin Durant after the game praising Jared Allen the way he did, it seems like he knows that Jared Allen is the better player and he's going to continue to improve and be possibly one of the X factors for the Nets in the postseason. DeAndre Jordan is not going to be that guy. He's past his prime in that aspect. And like you said, guys are tired. Play some of the rest of the roster. Sean Marks gifted you this beautiful 15-man roster with playable two-way players too, and yet you still elect to not use everybody to the best of their ability.
Yeah, and look, there's a quote that from Matt Brooks as well on his Twitter, you know, obviously speaking to Chris Chioza right now. Chris Chioza says he, Reggie Perry, Bruce Brown, TLC, and Rodion Skuritz, the quote, stay ready group, spend a lot of time at practice together. You guessed it, staying ready. Mm-hmm. Now, if they're ready, use them. Use them, Steve. Just use them, mate.
The Bruce Brown thing I just find so strange. That's the one thing that it's hard to grasp, because Sean Marks obviously values him, or he wouldn't have traded for him. You know what I mean? Like, he went out and acquired this player. Maybe he was just trying to turn Jonathan Musa into a usable player. Maybe that's the case, but he attached a second-round pick. You would think he believes Bruce Brown could have an impact on this team. Tyler Johnson, you want to say he's just a tag-along at the end of the bench? Fine, because they signed him on a minimum contract to be the 15th man. Fine, but Bruce Brown, they literally traded for to fill a need.
Yep. Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, obviously, you know, there was a part of me in the back of my head that I'm like, maybe Steve Nash is going to get wacky with him and throw Bruce Brown in the starting lineup to go on Ja Morant. You know, that was the optimist in me. But yep, obviously that optimism, it's why I'm the pessimist on the pod, Nick. It's why I always downplay stuff in that sort of respect. We got another quote from TLC. He said he thought the Grizzlies defense stuck with him and Joe Harris more in the second half and let LeVert beat them more off the pick and roll. So, look, I think that there was just team basketball in the first half, you know, divulged into Hero, Karras, Chioza ball. And I'm just like, that's not good basketball at the end of the day, as we alluded to earlier in the pod.
And I think the Nets were almost being lazy, because sure, they're playing better defense maybe in the second half, but a lot of the reasons they got so open on a lot of the screens in the first half was there was multiple screens set from numerous players, or there was a lot of action with the ball and the players going from court side of each side of the court. You know what I mean? Instead of just like, let's run this little action, try to get open for 2 seconds. Oh, it doesn't work. Let's stop. So it's just like the team didn't have the effort. The coaching was bad. A game that we'd like to forget.
Yeah, maybe that's the title of this pod, Nick. I think you figured it out for yourself just talking through this sort of therapy session, as we like to call them sometimes, with these Brooklyn Nets. Nick, I'm not sure if you wanted to make this an hour pod and divulge into the Forbes article on the story of Sean Marks' ascendancy into the GM position for the Brooklyn Nets. It was it's a fascinating article, and I highly recommend everyone check it out. It's on Forbes and their sports section, and you know, it sort of goes into, you know, where Sean Marks came from, and you know, the behind the scenes of the hiring process, and it's a really good read.
Yeah, Jack, if you want to summarize it a little, I didn't get a chance to read it yet, then I'll probably check it out after the game. But you mentioned that it had some really nice details in there.
Well, there's things like, you know, Calipari apparently was scattered quite heavily, and he wanted to have full autonomy over not only the coaching, but sort of like, you know, Doc Rivers and Tom Thibodeau in seasons past, and sort of be the coach GM, which I thought was like, okay, wow. You know,
one of the worst idea possible.
And thank God it didn't happen. Apparently he wanted a 10-year, $120 million deal. So thankfully that didn't happen. And Sean Marks apparently almost didn't take the job because, you know, they were trying to lowball him. Mikhail Prokhorov was trying to lowball him with just like a $1 million contract, which is what he was getting when he was in San Antonio as a sort of assistant GM. But then, you know, he's like, you know what, I'm not taking this job unless you at least double my pay. And they did. And, you know, the rest is history sort of there. So there's a lot of different sort of things. And the one surprising thing was that apparently Sean Marks was highly intrigued by the vacancy that he said, saying that, quote, this job is mine. And then one person who knows Marks well put it, his ego is the size of several small planets combined. I'm just like, my dude Sean Marks got the ego. And I'm just like, you can tell that's probably like a friend just throwing him under the bus. But it shows that, you know, Sean Marks has confidence in, you know, his abilities and his intelligence.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, the ego thing, like, isn't super surprising based on the way he talks sometimes. Like, you can kind of get some of that sneaky confidence where he doesn't necessarily come out. He's smart with what he says to the media, but you can kind of read some of his body language at times. And like, okay, this guy feels pretty good. I mean, like, let's be honest, though. Like, he deserves to have confidence. He turned one of the worst situations in the NBA into what looks like a championship contender this year and has a chance to go to the finals for more than one season.
Yeah, and another thing as well, Mark stood out obviously in the interview process because there was the likes of Brian Colangelo apparently being scouted, Arturis Kanashovas, and a lot of other sort of candidates that were in the sort of running. And also, who's the dude in Minnesota right now, former Houston Rockets assistant?
Tip of my tongue right now, too.
You look it up while I give you a little bit more of behind the scenes here. Apparently, Mark stood out in the interview process, and it was he won over Irina Pavlova and also Sergei Koshenko. And he said that he didn't want to guarantee anything, especially given all the challenges that he faced, you know, with all the lack of picks and the disastrous nature of where the team was at. but he said that he believed a five-year rebuild was feasible. And look, you know, it kind of did happen. And it's not that there haven't been some missteps along the way and quite a bit of luck, you know, not getting Tyler Johnson and Otto Porter Jr. with those sort of offer sheets and a bit of bad luck with the Allen Crabbe and, you know, offering Torian Prince. But, you know, he's done a lot of good things, and that five-year rebuild has happened. The Brooklyn Nets are now within that sort of realm of elite teams that could be fighting for a championship.
And Gerson Rosas.
Gerson Rosas. There we go. Yep.
He's president of basketball operations. That's why. And Scott Layden is the general manager. But he's the guy that makes all the decisions, Rosas. But like you said, so, yeah, I mean, it's been remarkable to watch Sean Marks kind of grow too into the person he is. And like you said, there's been a few blemishes on there. You mentioned earlier today the Torian Prince contract isn't great. See how that goes for the rest of that time. But maybe it could be used in a trade, so we kind of forget about it.
Yeah, look, if we get George Hill or Aaron Gordon out of it, then I'm going to be happy, Nick, because I think both of those guys, all one of those guys, can add something to the Brooklyn Nets. And, you know, Sean Marks said he's not done yet, and hopefully he is, and hopefully he's still looking for ways to make this team better. One final thing I wanted to bring, Nick, you know, trying to be an aggregator, it's a little bit tricky, but on here, I think it was Brett Ford, I think his name is, he was a key part of the hiring process. He said, on paper, hiring Sean didn't make sense since he was only 4 years removed from the end of his playing career. But he was prepared, he had strong values and principles, and believed in collaboration. He pulled the right levers, but I don't think he cut any corners. His ability to communicate is his number one strength. That sounds a lot like the Steve Nash hiring.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, communication is huge, especially in the NBA when you have so many characters, personalities, egos to deal with. I mean, it also makes a lot of sense why they're good friends.
Yeah, communication, collaboration, didn't make a lot of sense, surprise hiring, all these sort of things. So, look, hopefully Sean let him know, hey, I got your Bruce Brown for nothing. I didn't get your Bruce Brown for nothing, Steve. Hopefully he's having some tough conversation with him. And, you know, communicating is his number one strength. Hopefully he's communicating a lot of our frustrations. Hopefully he's listened to the buzz, Sean. Come on, mate. You got to show some love to your Southern Hemisphere Australian brother across the transatlantic.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. That's a dynamic I haven't really thought much about until tonight, is how Sean Marks and Steve Nash will interact, as everything was so gravy early on, or this is kind of the first hiccup. You know what I mean? And, like, we don't know how much is Steve Nash, how much is Mike D'Antoni drawing the out-of-timeout plays, or who's influencing that, but maybe it's time for Steve Nash to kind of unlock himself a little bit and be willing to get uncomfortable and be creative. That's what I'm looking for in Atlanta. I'm looking for adjustments and changes.
Willing to get uncomfortable. We're not Houston, Nick. Come on, mate. Calm down. You know, we might want James Harden, but we don't get too uncomfortable down here because, you know, we know what can happen. We see it. We're seeing what's happening there in Houston Rockets land. But, yeah, I think I'm intrigued to see, you know, whether KD and Kyrie are playing, you know, one or both of those matchups, whether one is or whether both of them are. It's going to be interesting to see how their sort of load management, quote-unquote, is dealt with because, you know, they are so damn important, you know, with any sort of team. When you don't have your two best players out there, imagine the Los Angeles Lakers, who apparently, another person argued to me, has greater depth than the Brooklyn Nets. Imagine they're without AD and LeBron. You know, they're not going to be winning many games, but the Brooklyn Nets obviously have a really great third player, and, you know, we saw what happened in the bubble, and the depth is clearly on play. But, you know, no excuses.
And if Spencer's healthy, they probably win this game.
If there's a lot of reasons why they could have won this game, Nick, and that's probably another good one too. So, look, hopefully a lot of these ailments and frustrations and gripes that we have are ailed with a big win over the Atlanta Hawks, or two big wins over the Atlanta Hawks, but either way, we'll be recapping one and both of them going forward. But fingers crossed, whether it's no Kyrie, no KD, or they're both back or one's back, as long as we're winning, it makes us a lot happier on this podcast.
Yeah, I expect both to play. I think it was just a rest thing. I mean, I don't find it interesting they both rested at the same time, but I think moving forward without Spencer, it would make so much more sense to rest one on the first night of a back-to-back and rest the second on the other night of the back-to-back if you're really concerned about winning games in the regular season. Unless you're not and you don't really care and you just want to make these guys happy and let it go to the postseason and kind of getting things in groove that way. But like you said, I think the Atlanta is going to be a good test, very potent offense, 3-0, and you can't mess around against that team because they are talented and they can blow you out real quick.
Well, yeah, you got to be locked in defensively with those guys. One thing I wanted to ask, because it sort of sprung to mind, Nick, we heard KD obviously at the end of the Charlotte Hornets game saying, you know, he wants to play back-to-backs. And we heard behind the scenes, I think it was Malika Andrews and some other Nets reporters sort of say that the decision to rest and load managed KD was made the evening of the Charlotte Hornets game, whereas Kyrie's resting was made the decision in the morning of the game. Do you think that KD and KD had any say in it, or was he overridden by Steve Nash and Sean Marks and the analytics crew and the training crew behind the scenes? Because it seems to me that both of these guys are obsessed with basketball. So does the tactics of their load management need to sort of change, like you mentioned?
I would say the only thing that this situation just made the most sense for load management is that it's the third game in four nights, and it's the first stretch of that during the season, and both guys haven't played basketball in so long that, like, I get that. Now, if it's a back-to-back in the middle of the season and there's 2 days rest before and 2 days rest after, then I think that's maybe where you try out Kevin Durant or you try out Kyrie Irving in that back-to-back setting. But I don't know if you have to do that. Like I said, maybe it's that, you play KD night one, you play Kyrie night two. I don't know if they're open to that. And to be honest, like, Kyrie's load management is a little bit different than Kevin Durant's, where Kevin Durant's is, I think, something more set in stone. He's coming off a torn Achilles and hasn't played basketball in 18 months. Kyrie played last season, only played 20-ish games, but his injury isn't as likely to be re-injured, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be more that Kyrie Irving is an injury-prone player, and we're trying to protect him from himself in a lot of ways. Like, that one-legged fadeaway, I'm sure you and Nolan certainly were raving about it on the buzz yesterday. So, yeah, it's about sort of management going forward, and it's going to be one of the many storylines that we continue to analyze on this podcast. And, man, Nick, I'm hoping for a win because I'm not feeling too good right now. But
I'm feeling a little better after we got it out for an hour, so.
Yeah, I mean, it does help. It does help. And, somehow we get an hour out of a game recap. I don't know how, but, it's therapeutic in at least some way.
Yeah, and obviously Nets fans moving forward, too, and we've mentioned this in the past. The game sucks. You want to get thoughts out, feel free to tweet me and Jack at the JManJBT, at OTGNicks. And as always, you can find us on all streaming platforms, including OTGBasketball.com, BlueWirePods, and NetsRepublic.com.